This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to the Better Together Conference podcast. This session is from the 2021 conference held at the Adelaide Convention Centre and proudly recorded and produced by Joy 94.9. For a full list of all the recorded talks at the conference, visit joy.org.au/bettertogether or search Better Together on your favourite podcast platform. And for more information on the next conference, visit theequalityproject.org.au.
Yes, this is a paper that's been done in various versions in various places. The last version was in 2018, I think. When was 2019 in Melbourne? But it always changes a little bit, at least. But the reason why this one has been presented is the organisers of this conference originally submitted these two papers, those ideas. And they said, no, you can only have one. So I was going to do gender transitioning in the 90s. Then about a week ago, because of COVID and cancellations, they said, oh, can you do the other one as well for us, please? So I've had to sort of pull it out and revise it and read through it and look at it and pull it together, and hopefully it's in a presentable state for this conference. I chose to change, you might notice, some little ribbons to trans pride ribbons. I just decided to throw in a bit of trans pride in these things as well. And if you ever saw Looking For Me, that's my Twitter thingy down there, at @ADL_archivist. I think it is _archivist, yes. Anyway. So we'll get on. And we'll begin by acknowledging that we meet today in the land of the Kaurna people, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today. I pay my respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past, present, and emerging. Always was, always will be, Kaurna land. That's a photograph I took at the Invasion Day march in Adelaide in January this year. I'm very proud to have photographed many social justice movements in Adelaide over the years, and I donate photographs to the State Library for permanent retention in the archival collections. It's just something I like to do. And the other thing I said to the previous group, so my apologies for people who are listening to me twice, I think some of the really, really best memories and times I've had have been sitting at the knee of Kaurna elders, some of the aunties, and listening to their stories from the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, that sort of makes you very, very grateful and appreciative to be able to live on Kaurna land. Always will be. And just to know those stories, hear those stories from their lips. Wow. That's just great. Just never can get over that. Anyway. Oh, sorry. I meant to read this. I prefer just to talk, but I meant to read this. So this paper draws on research that I have presented at earlier conferences. The title of today's talk, Finding Lesbians at the Archives, is based on some attitudes that have confronted me in the course of researching discussing my subjects. Power and the law are never... The last one's much more comfortable because I just talked to the slides, but this is much more structured, you know, because it was done for universities and things. The power and the law are never constant. At the beginning of the 20th century, women, non-white men, working class men, and much of the world did not have the franchise. Homosexual acts between men remained illegal. Rarely were the voices of men or women who identified as homosexual or lesbian heard, and even less so those of transgender people whose identity would not even enter the vocabulary for many decades. We don't have to look far to find evidence of attempts to make LGBTIQ people invisible. There are always people who, for whatever reason, but most commonly the acquisition of personal power, will seek to make invisible groups of people they can name as other. That's us, LGBTQI other. And we know the sort of people. Russia tells you and there are no gays in Chechnya. Well, certainly after they deported or murdered them, they possibly weren't. Despite the best efforts of others, hints to the presence of our LGBTIQ forebears have always been there, most often barely discernible amid the dominant discourse of history. Too often, modern historians of LGBTIQ history have had to rely on reports of suicides or salacious newspaper reports of criminal trials to find the men and transgender people of our history. This is Bert Edwards, so it's a famous case in South Australia for those of you who from the 1931, an Adelaide City councillor, gay man and philanthropist who did lots of really good work in the West End of Adelaide, but the powers that be still sent him to prison. Got out of prison, he went back to being a councillor and he went back to doing good work. But yes, they couldn't let him forget that he was gay. Too often modern historians of LGBTIQ history have had to rely on reports of that. Within this framework, homophobia and transphobia thrive, perpetuating a historical perspective of LGBTIQ people as criminal or mentally ill. Where are the stories of love? Where are the stories of success? Where are the stories of victory? Women in same-sex relationships are even harder to find, as their relationships, although considered immoral, were not illegal. Within the misogynist social structure of the 19th and 20th century, the lives and relationships were often ignored as of little consequence, particularly when compared with the abhorrent activities of the homosexuals and transvestites, abhorrent and against the natural order, that is, according to the white men, the politicians, the priests, the judiciary, who made society's rules to suit themselves. Since before the time of Herodotus, the history of the Western world has been recorded through the prism of the male gaze. Certainly after my appointment as pictorial curator at the State Library of South Australia in 2000, two items attracted my attention. One, a single photograph. Let me just flip this on. One, a single photograph, and the other, a photograph album. Both dated between the wars, that is, the 21 years between World War I and World War II, those wars. The first was the small photo of two women sitting in a cart described as Mabel Doswell and her friend Rita at Martindale Hall. Now, some of you from South Australia will know what Martindale Hall is, in the mid-north of South Australia, up by Clare. And a historic house these days, but lots of history. The term friend. There's one I will return to. It has a long history as a euphemism for relationships between same-sex couples. And because of this, wherever I find it, it piques my interest. If you have seen the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, you may remember that toward the end, Freddie Mercury introduces Jim Hutton to his parents as his friend. The etymology of the word is surely worthy of a thesis. I had to explore the small photo of Mabel and Rita further. That's Martindale Hall. There was much to discover. Martindale Hall in the Clare Valley has a special place in South Australian history, being the home of the pastoralist and benefactor Mortlock family. This photograph led me to loose pages of a photo album. Also in the collection, pages that confirmed the close association of the Mortlock family and Ina Mabel Doswell, and Mabel Doswell's close association with Miss Rita Templer. It is here the discovery of relationships and the definition of what we are able to discern constituted a romantic relationship in a time when language was different and discretion the norm, perhaps problematic. Thanks to the passing of women's suffrage in South Australia in 1894, women became less invisible in the historical record, and we can discover in the electoral rolls that in 1917, Mabel, aged 40, who we will find was later affectionately called Dosey by Rita, and Rita, aged 24, were living one door apart on Hawkers Road, Medindie. the records there. What transpired on Hawkers Road at the end of the war, we cannot know. But in 1919, Rita had moved into Mabel's house, and they continued to reside there for 5 years before they moved together into a house at 23 Kingston Terrace at Medindi. This is something in North Adelaide, for those of you who aren't locals. This house, the certificate of title records, was purchased by Ina, but which a note of the archival record claims was purchased for Ina by the Mortlock family in order to provide a place for Frederick Ranson Mortlock, the unmarried son of William Tennant Mortlock and Rosina Forsyth Tennant, to stay when he was in Adelaide. According to the electoral rolls, Ina and Rita continued to live together at 23 Kingston Terrace for 14 years when in 1939 Rita moved to Victoria. Houses were. Neither Dosey or Rita ever married, and I have not been able to find any evidence of either woman having an intimate relationship with anyone else. Dosey died in 1961 and Rita in Victoria in 1973. They are both buried in the North Road Cemetery at Nailsworth. Now, there is much more, not together, they are separately. But it's so nice if they'd actually been buried together, but they weren't. I might have said a lot more, but never mind. Now, there is much more to the story and their lives continue to intrigue me, but of equal interest to me is the response that I received after I told the story of Dosey and Rita at a History Trust Talking History lecture in 2016. Two women separately came up to me to propose alternatives. These are two white women, presumably straight, I didn't ask, in their 60s, yeah, fairly typical heteronormative white-looking South Australians. I keep losing my spot. My apologies. Two women separately came up to me to propose alternatives to a romantic relationship between Ina and Rita, such as they could have been cousins, or I suspect they saw a relationship in the context of sexual relationship, and in truth at the time, that was likely what I was seeking as well. I have no documentary evidence that confirms a sexual or romantic relationship, but their remarks 5 years ago have left me contemplating the question, what do we mean when we say romantic relationship between women? What is a relationship? What is an intimate relationship? What is a romantic relationship? What is a lesbian relationship? I suggest that most in the heterosexual community and the LGBTIQ community define romantic or intimate by sexuality. Even we define our difference by our sexuality. But when looking for intimate romantic relationships between women, are we too often being limited by heteronormative concepts? Even when I say sex, what is that? Language, definitions, and meaning over time are so very important when interrogating the archival record. As I have been looking for relationships between women prior to the Marriage Amendment Definition on Religious Freedoms Act 2017 that commenced on the 9th of December 2017, I set aside the definition of a relationship within marriage and went looking for official definitions of de facto relationships. That was their house. Sorry, I probably should have. That was the house that they moved into, that was brought to them by the Mortlock family. So anyway, the Department of... have to go to the Department of Human Services for definitions. Department of Human Services website defines de facto relationship as where you and your partner meet both of these conditions. One, you're in a relationship similar to a married couple. Two, you aren't married or in a registered relationship. There's no minimum time period for a relationship to be de facto. Similar to a married couple. What is that? You know? It's a bit like, oh, yes. What we consider when assessing, we'll get through these bits. What we consider when assessing a member of a couple, to determine if you're a member of a couple, we may need to assess your relationship. We'll consider the following five factors: the financial aspect, nature of your household, whatever that means, social aspects of your relationship, like party together, if you have a sexual relationship, and what constitutes a sexual relationship is my question on that one then. Nature of your commitment to each other. So If you tell us you're a member of a couple, we don't usually assess your relationship against these factors. We may look at these factors if your circumstances change. We can decide you're a member of a couple even if all of these factors aren't part of your relationship. So, oh, you're sitting together, you're going to be a couple? Oh, we're going to set your appointment, my God. Don't you just... So I returned to Dosi Rita and other women of their time. Discovering the financial aspects of the relationship is which, sadly, what happens is archives really keep as financial records. It's strange, really, because financial records still say much about people, but nationally and globally, as far as I know, they don't tend to like keeping financial records. As an archivist, I can't explain it, but there you go. Discovering the financial aspects of the relationship is virtually impossible. So few financial records are preserved, and I have to think that any that survived would not routinely be retained by an archive. The nature of the household, what does that actually mean? There is not a lot of discoverable evidence of the social aspects of their relationship, and there are no children or other evidence of a sexual relationship. It seems we all have our own ad hoc definitions of what constitutes a relationship, and it's almost as though to be recognised conclusively as a couple, they had to be married. Anything less is open to debate and conjecture, particularly those people who want us to remain invisible. As for Dosi and Rita, all we know is that they lived together under the same roof, including moving house together for 20 years. There is no evidence of another relationship that I've been able to find. We know that they were guests of Rosina Morlock at Martindale Hall and recorded in Rita's small notebook somewhere. This is probably one of the more telling bits. Recorded in Rita's small notebook is the notation, Dosi went to Martindale Hall 52 years ago on 28th of June 1954. Now, Rita wrote this some 15 years after she moved to Victoria. So she was, she knew that this was an important anniversary that she just wrote down for whatever reason in her notebook all those years after she wasn't living. She had there's stuff in the archive. This is the value down code, but there is. It's a little blue notebook where she put in newspaper cuttings and little notations like this. There's some stuff around women's rights movement and working women in there. I can't remember off the top of my head what else was there. So there wasn't anything obviously explicit, but you've got to go. Sorry, I moved away from the mic. You've got to go looking and try and interpret. Why did she write that all those years later if her relationship wasn't significant? Well, she said, so this is 52 years. So she wrote, hang on, let me get back. Rita wrote this some 15 years after she moved to Victoria. So 15 years after she moved out of the house with Dosi, in Victoria, she's writing this. That to me is a big clue of something more than just a casual friendship. Is this enough? Probably not, and that is my question. Did they consider themselves lesbians? What, without a marriage or other documentary evidence, can we assume any two people are more than friends? Going by the Department of Human Services definition of a de facto couple, would they consider them a couple? Now let me turn to two other women who, strictly speaking, never lived together. The album that piqued my interest was assigned the title Holiday Views by an anonymous archivist and identified on the cover title as Molly, Christmas 1926. This album intrigued me. Perhaps it was radar or something else, but there was something intimate about the numerous photographs of young women. Don't get me wrong, there are numerous photographs of young men as well, and even photographs of young women with young men. But there was something about viewing this with a queer eye that perhaps straight people wouldn't pick up. The album had lots of names repeated. Rita, Margaret, Matt, Joe and Vi, to name a few. And yes, there were a lot of holiday views. Holidays at Port Noarlunga, at Mount Gambier, at Manham, at Kangaroo Island, and the Gulf Cruise and the newly commissioned Adelaide Steamship Company's MV Moonta. Got a few snaps here. Anyway, I like this. Move along. That's one of my favourite photos. I love that. Young woman of their time with this new technology. So where was I? Molly's album proved to be an enigma. Despite lots of clues and my best efforts, I failed to find the identities or relationships of Molly and her friends. Not even the provenance of the album offered a clue. It had been purchased in a second-hand shop and donated to the library. So that is okay. So that is where Molly's album rested for 15 years, always in the back of my mind and occasionally revisited. I just go down to the stacks and look at it, just because I liked it. Yeah, I could do that in those days. That was until 2018. At one of the archival team's regular archival collection development meetings were four photograph albums. Initially, they looked typical of albums of their time. I'll leave that one up for now. That's mine. It's more interesting. Family snaps of post-World War I South Australians. The albums had belonged to two sisters. One was that of Gwen Francis, and three belonged to Joyce Koenig. They had been donated by a nephew. Within their covers lay a revelation. Here on just one page were five photos that I knew well. They were in Molly's album. This is just too good. This is just like, wow. I noted that my straight colleagues failed to appreciate my excitement. You know, I was beside myself. I was I was almost wetting myself with excitement. God, this is Molly. You know, oh God. I still think about it. Yes, a reaction that disappointed me but demonstrated for me the importance of having minority representation in archives. Can a white person always see the significance in a record that a person of colour does, or a straight person versus a queer person, etc.? In a profession dominated by white, straight, able-bodied archivists, communities should be provided with the opportunity to participate in the appraisal process lest archives of community significance are rejected or, worse, destroyed. Significance can be very subtle. It's only because, you know, I'd sat on this other album for 15 years. You know, if I'd moved on to something else, it was only the length of time I had been there, the interest I had in that album, and then this one pops up 15 years later. I immediately matched the significance of that album. It was just, it told me so much. Anyway, the provenance of these albums quickly proved answers to many of my questions about Molly's album. Joe was Joyce Koenig, and Vi was Violet LeCornu. With the magic of Trove, LeCornu name is a bit South Australian too. With the magic of Trove and a few research tools, it didn't take long to discover something of the lives of Joyce and Violet. That's just some more things about the two albums. Here are Vi and Joe in London. It was relatively easy to date and place this photo, as we know they're on their way to an afternoon party in the garden at Buckingham Palace. There's the invitation. Also, Jo kept newspaper clippings in her albums, one from The Advertiser dated 27th of March 1957, before she and Vi left on their trip, and another from The News dated 4th of January 1959 after the return. Interestingly, Jo refers to Vi as her friend. But what of them before 1957? Violet was born in South Australia on the 30th of August 1906, and Joyce 11 weeks later on the 16th of November 1906. In correspondence with Joyce's nephew and donor of the albums replying to my questions, he confirmed that, quote, I cannot, and sadly this donor has since died, the nephew, he's passed away anyway, and there was other stuff gone on since. He said, I cannot enlighten you greatly except to verify that Joe would be Joyce and that Vi would be Violet LeCornu. Joyce and Vi were lifetime inseparable friends, neither married. Quote, end quote. relatives often speak in generalizations that I can, and I, since after he died, the donor died, I tried emailing him and I didn't know he had died, and his daughter rang me, and I, because I'd never, he never quite say, you know, particularly to an old, he was a very elderly man when he donated his albums, you know, well in his 80s or 90s, possibly. And how do you say, do you think Auntie was a dyke? You can't actually say that to people. You've got to be a bit sensitive to them. But when I was talking to the donor's daughter on the phone, I said, do you think there might have been a lesbian relationship? And she, you know, she was a younger generation. And she said, we don't know, but we often wondered. Maybe that's why I'll ever know. You know, but so it had occurred to younger generations that these were. And relatives often speak in generalisations that I can only assume are meant to inform without being explicit. Many of us remember when descendants denied having convict ancestors because of social mores, or when first Australians denied their heritage because of discrimination. I wonder if straight people embracing the LGBTIQ ancestors won't be the next hurdle toward a celebration of difference. Trove confirmed the details of Joe and Vi's many travels together. January 92, returned from a holiday in Victoria. January 1935, returned from a holiday in Victoria. They liked Victoria, obviously. They're always Victoria. Yeah. But every year they go away on holidays together. And the news of the 5th of September 1932 reported that Mrs. Margaret Campbell of Glen Osmond, Molly Stokes of Alberton, Joyce Kernock of Croydon, and Violet LaCornu of Lockleys spent the week at Port Nolunga. There we are. There's something for people down south. We know from the electoral rolls and newspaper reports that Joe and Vi lived separately. We know they held positions of importance for women of their generation. Joe was personal secretary to the director of the South Australian Tourist Bureau, and Vi the personal secretary to the manager of director of F.H. Faldings. When they travelled overseas in 1957, Joe carried a personal passport like a document, personal passport-like document from the Premier Tom Playford. I don't have a photo of that here, but I don't. On turning 60 in 1966, of course they both turned 60 very close together too, both would have been required to retire because women had to retire when they turned 60 in those days. And in 1968, the electoral rolls revealed that they moved into adjoining units in Beaumont, Joe in number 4 and Vi in number 6. That's them next door to each other. On the 22nd of January 1991, they visited lawyers in Adelaide to make their wills. So they're going to lawyers together to make the wills. Joyce left one half share to her of her estate to her nephew, and the remaining half to be divided equally between her friend Violet LaCornu, her nephews, and great nephew. Violet left $1,000 to her friend Joyce, to whom she also gave and bequeathed all her household furniture and effects, jewellery, watches, and personal effects. Wills are wonderful things. On the 27th of... Let me just see if I'm looking along here. On the 27th of November 1996, Vi died at Ellen Tinsley Hostel, Morvet Vale, and a little over 7 months later, on the 7th of July 1997, Joe died, also at Ellen Tinsley Hostel. So they were in the same aged care facility together, and they were born within months of each other, and they died within months of each other. It is sad that when Vi died, none of her family thought to mention Joe in the death notices. But when Joe died, her family noted lifetime friend of the late Violet LaCornu. In the discoverable record of Dosie and Rita, I'm not sure which side I'm up to now, but that's their death notices. In the discoverable record of Dosie and Rita, Joe and Vi, we have insight into the lives of four South Australian women, women who lived independently, who never married, who never had children. The exact nature of their relationship we can only surmise. It is that enigma that gives conservative and fundamentalist opponents of LGBTIQ rights the vehicle to deny our existence in history. I'm constantly frustrated by the opponents of programs such as Safe Schools who make claims about gender whisperers, gay agendas, etc. I say to anyone who will listen that I was a trans child in 1958, that despite the protestations of the religious fundamentalists, being trans is not new. We have always been here, made invisible by fear and discrimination. Why did they oppose marriage equality so vehemently? For many reasons, I suspect, but principal among them, I believe, is that for the first time, our loving, committed relationships will be discoverable and identifiable. There will not be the need for conjecture or supposition. Those young LGBTIQ people who come after us will not need to rely on the criminal and salacious record to find their history. It is in the documented visibility of loving, committed relationships between LGBTIQ people brought about by marriage equality that future generations will find the stories of love, the stories of success, the stories of victory, where their forebears overcame considerable adversity and thrived. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Better Together Conference podcast, proudly recorded and produced by Joy 94.9. For a full list of all the recorded talks at the conference, visit joy.org.au/bettertogether or search Better Together on your favourite podcast platform. And for more information on the next conference, visit theequalityproject.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.